Hey everyone, it's May and welcome to another episode of The May Lee Show. Happy New Year. I think I can still say that again. I'm recording this episode on January 11th, at least this part of the episode. I took a little bit of a break. I was going to actually release this episode last week, but because of what happened in Washington, D.C. and the terrorist attack on the U.S. Capitol, I held off just because, like everyone else, I was completely stunned, disheartened, disgusted. It was a shameful day in American history. And it was just something that I think I'm still processing. I don't know about you guys. I'm still processing it because I still cannot believe that this kind of domestic terrorism, this insurrection took place in America, in Washington, D.C., against a branch of the U.S. government, and looks like it was incited by the one and only U.S. President Donald Trump. So I'm actually still processing it, and obviously we're all still gathering all of this information and finding out more about what happened last Wednesday, and it is just gets more and more disturbing. And of course, now we're being warned about more attacks that these insane extremists are planning. So I know you guys know how much I love to talk about politics and about news of the world and topics exactly like this. But I'm not going to address it in this episode because there's just so much. There's so much to talk about. There's so much there. And look, my dogs know how upsetting this is to me. So for those of you who are listening to the podcast right now, my little dog, Sugi's trying to climb on my lap. My dog, Eggy, is behind me. But it has been such an upsetting week because of what happened in D.C. and because of the ongoing controversy and again, the ongoing information that's coming out about everything, that I still need to process it. And as many of you know who follow me on Instagram, a lot of this stuff I talk about on Instagram. So keep tuning in on Instagram because don't worry, I will continue to address this particular topic and share whatever information I gather and some of my thoughts. So I'll leave it at this. Don't underestimate what happened on January 6th, 2021. That is a day that will truly live in infamy as one of the darkest days in U.S. history. Who could have ever imagined that something like this would happen in a democracy like the United States? And what I think is most upsetting to me, and it should be to every U.S. citizen and people around the world, is that America was always seen as the true democracy, the shining example. And we could go around the world and preach the glory and the benefits of a democratic society and try to preach this to countries around the world and different systems. And now look at us. We are now seen as this joke that we have this double standard that we can't even uphold our own democratic principles. So that is damage that I think is going to last quite a bit of time. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have a huge, huge mess on their hands that they're going to be taking over and inheriting on January 20th. But let's give them our good energy and pray and whatever you need to do that we can somehow heal this nation and heal this incredible divide that now exists and move forward to be able to come together and rebuild what has been destroyed. It's not irreparable. There's been extensive damage for sure, but it's not irreparable. And I want all of you to take this very seriously, that this is nothing to just dismiss. This is something we all need to think about long and hard and think about how each one of us could contribute in the healing process, whatever that might be. I really want you all to think about it and apply some way, even if it's just changing your thoughts for a second or talking to a friend who you may differ with, saying a prayer, whatever it takes for us to feel like we can all take some sort of action. Because we can't go on like this. We cannot go on like this. Okay. All right. That's enough of that. Now, for today's episode, it's about COVID-19. Now, we know that we are in a terrible way with COVID. It seems like we're still going into even a darker place with numbers going up, case numbers going up, hospitalizations going up, the number of deaths going up. And so this is a crisis that we're also dealing with on top of this political crisis that has gotten bigger. So now we are hearing about all the vaccines, of course, that are being distributed. Well, they should be being distributed faster, but that's, again, another story. However, we now have two vaccines here in the U.S., Pfizer and Moderna, and AstraZeneca, the U.K., has adopted as well, and now using that vaccine, the third vaccine. There is a fourth vaccine that is coming down the pipeline sooner than later, and that is Johnson & Johnson. And it was developed by their company, their Belgian unit, which is called Janssen. I think it's called Janssen. I've heard it Janssen. So Janssen Pharmaceutica. And it's a Belgian unit of J&J. So this vaccine, they just finished their phase 3 clinical trials with 45,000 people around the world. They are supposed to submit their final data sometime the end of January. And if it looks good and it's approved, they're going to get the emergency approval, just like the others have. And the vaccine could be available by sometime in February. Now, the J&J vaccine is different because it only requires one dose, just one shot. Because remember, the other vaccines that are out there right now require two doses. And that's posing some issues because of the delay and how many doses are out there and et cetera, et cetera. So the J&J vaccine requires only one shot. So that could be a game changer in many ways. And J&J is prepared to roll out hundreds of millions of doses if all goes well. Now, the reason why I'm emphasizing J&J is because, drum roll please, back in December, I decided to participate in the phase 3 trial of the J&J vaccine. So I agreed to be one of the participants, one of the 45,000 in phase 3. I did it because a couple reasons. One of the biggest, really, was that I had heard that there has always been a lack of diversity when it comes to these clinical trials, that they weren't recruiting enough people of color from different backgrounds. So that is a problem because when it comes to vaccine development, you have to have a good cross-section of different ethnicities and races and cultural backgrounds. Because that people react differently. Vaccines respond differently depending on, you know, your physiology, and that includes race and ethnicity. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to participate. Two, of course, there was a curiosity on my part. I'm a journalist and I was very curious about the clinical trial process. And so I happened to find out that a friend of mine was involved in being a participant, and he called me and said, "Hey, May, they're looking for more people, especially people of color. Would you be interested?" And I was like, "You know what? Maybe I would be." So I made the phone call and they immediately took me in. And so I decided to go for it. And, you know, I mean, yes, there are risks involved, but, you know, life is full of risks. And I also thought that because we're in this state of emergency with COVID, maybe this would be one of my contributions somehow. So it was December 17th. I went in for the first part of the trial, which involved me signing some documents and then getting the first shot. It's a double blind trial. And that means that nobody knows what the person is getting. I didn't know if I was getting the real thing or the placebo. The people administering the shot, they don't know if they're giving the placebo or the real thing. So it's double blind. And I still don't know. It's been a couple of weeks. I still don't know. Now, I documented everything that day when I went to the trial. So take a look at this quick video of me going through the day that I went to the clinic. All right, check it out.
I just filled out a bunch of paperwork, all these sort of disclaimers and releases and medical history and things like that. So it was about 40 pages of documents I had to go through. And now I'm just waiting to go to the next step, whatever that might be. So I'll keep you posted. Okay, so now I'm in an exam room and I went through one stage of being checked out and now I'm in stage two. This is Princess.
Yes.
Hi. I'm not exactly sure what she's going to do. I think she's just making sure that my records are straight.
Yes, and then right. I'll be conducting your visit too okay. so that I can enroll you so they can prepare your dose.
Great. Okay, and again, I don't know if I'm going to get a placebo or the real thing. So we don't know this. This is a double blind, so none of us know.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, I'll check in with you later.
Okay, I have to do a nasal swab, self-administered, so here we go. I know you guys really want to watch this. Okay. Actually, I'm going to use my camera as a mirror. So just go all the way around.
Yeah.
Is that about 10 seconds?
Yes, 10 seconds, and then you're going to go on the other side.
With the same swab?
Yes,
okay.
Correct.
Oh, this is so delightful. Eyes are watering. Okay. Okay. I think that should be good.
Okay. And then you're just going to drop it in there.
Drop it in here. Just like that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Now I'm going to get my blood drawn. So here we go. Got to find that nice vein.
Yep. You have good veins.
I have good veins. Okay, maybe you guys don't want to watch this. I don't know. But I'm going to videotape it anyway.
Perfect. You can release your fist.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
You're doing great.
Yeah, we're doing great. I think, and then after this, what happens?
You can download your app. Make mm-hmm. sure you do the two questionnaires. And after that, you'll be done. You'll be doing the doses. Right. Dosing.
Okay.
You'll be ready for dosing.
Great. Okay. See you in the next step.
All right. So right here, we put the yellow tape so that they can maintain the blind so that we will not know what you will be getting.
Right. So that is the reason for the double blind. Nobody knows.
Okay. It's time for me to get the shot. And again, we don't know if it's the vaccine or if it's the placebo. So, here it goes.
It's okay, I won't look.
Deep breath, small pull.
Just go around it.
Yes, just go around it. For 10 seconds.
Any time.
12, 15.
Full dose given.
Oh, same thing.
Yes, same thing.
There it is. All right.
Okay.
30 minutes from it's now done. Is your discharge time.
All right, so I have to wait 30 minutes to make sure that there's no reaction or of any kind. So I'm gonna wait and then I'll be free to go. And then we'll see, I guess. Okay. Well, that was about almost a month ago that I got the shot. And the next step is to go back. And what they'll do is actually test to see if I have antibodies or not. And of course, they're not going to tell me because, again, it's a blind study. So that's coming up this week for me. But in the meantime, I had a chance to interview Dr. Kenneth Kim, who is the ARC Clinical Research founder and CEO. And he is in charge of all the clinical trials that took place in Southern California, ARC Clinical. And so I had a chance to talk to him a couple weeks ago. Keep in mind that we talked back in December, right after I had done the clinical trial. And so some of it might sound a little bit dated, especially when we talk about the new variant COVID-19 virus that showed up in the UK. So that was a couple weeks ago. But besides that, everything else is really relevant and really interesting information that Dr. Kim shares about how trials take place, about how important they are, and about how different they are in terms of the J&J vaccine versus the Moderna versus the Pfizer. So I spoke to him. Got some great information. So here is that interview with Dr. Kim. All right. And Dr. Kenneth Kim joins me now. Hey, Ken, how are you? Thanks for joining me on the show.
Oh, thank you, May, for inviting me.
So as we just saw and heard, if you guys are listening to the podcast, I just went through the actual clinical trial. I volunteered and not realizing when I signed up that, Ken, you were part of this, that your company was actually conducting these vaccine trials. So if anybody is suspicious thinking that Ken got me in because we're friends, that's not the case. It was totally coincidental. But as we saw and heard, you know, I participated in this like tens of thousands of others have for the J&J vaccine. And your company was conducting it locally in Southern California. So tell me about the importance of these trials and how your company got involved in conducting the Southern California trials.
So these trials are obviously integral to attacking and addressing the coronavirus problem and pandemic as it affects the world and the nation. And the way, it is just one part of an armamentarium of tools that we need to use to combat the pandemic. Vaccinations is going to be one to develop some herd immunity. The other is going to be using common measures of social distancing and mask wearing, which I think has become much more widespread and accepted. And then developing some new treatment modalities. So if you are unlucky and happen to get the coronavirus, you have some treatment options. So I think all three of those things are going to be very important ways of fighting the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, let's,
the way we got involved. Oh,
sorry.
Go
ahead, Ken. Sorry about that.
We've been doing influenza research for years and. Been running clinical trials for over 20 years. Our site has run over 800 clinical trials, and we actually ran the first influenza challenge study in the United States back in 2014. And so that was a study that actually was looking at an influenza vaccine and actually intentionally infecting people with the flu and seeing whether the vaccine made a difference.
Okay. So in terms of COVID-19, it's one of those viruses where it just seems to be mystifying even the experts continuously. And so getting this vaccine to the stage of phase three trials, it has been at a record speed, right? We already have the Pfizer vaccine out. Moderna just got approved as well for emergency use. And J&J, I guess the estimation is that it might come out by January-ish. What do you know about that?
Well, so they're going to do a data cut, interim data analysis in the third week of January. Okay. About 45,000 patients were enrolled in the Janssen study. About 40,000 were enrolled into the Pfizer study and roughly about 30,000 in the Moderna study.
Yeah.
The Pfizer study, for example, vaccine was actually, the analysis was done when only 20,000 patients had a median of 2 months of follow-up. So really only half the data had been analyzed at the time that they did their data cut. And I think very similarly, the Janssen or Johnson & Johnson study that we're currently involved in will do a data cut in mid-January. And if you look at what happened with Moderna and with Pfizer, from the time they did their data cut and froze the data and then started analyzing it to the time they actually submitted their EUA, it was also sort of record speed. Yeah. It was roughly about 3 weeks. So if the data looks good, then one would expect an EUA application with this Janssen vaccine roughly mid-February.
Okay.
And then roll out to distribution by the end of February or March.
Okay.
And that's just estimates. If the data does not look good or the data cut says that you need more time, then there may be a delay in that timetable.
Well, here's the thing, Ken. I think a lot of lay people, even myself, and I actually participated in the trial, we kind of question, wow, this is great that all these vaccines were developed so quickly because of the need for it worldwide. And it really says so much about science and research. But at the same time, like you're saying, you know, the data has to be there. And if everything is being so rushed, this is not your typical vaccine development procedure. Usually, yes. Vaccine development and all the data that needs to be done and all the follow-up is years. So
that's correct.
That's why some people might say, man, this was way too fast. I don't trust this. I'm going to wait to see what happens to all of these people who get vaccinated initially, right? So how do you, how do people reconcile that when we're at this point where we really need to, you know, control this, but then you have maybe some doubts? What do you say as a researcher and a medical expert?
Well, you know, it's quite interesting because the first cohort of people that actually enrolled in our study and in many of the other studies were actually physicians or scientists or people who understood the science because they weren't afraid. And it's actually interesting because this trial, the way it was telescoped and all of the other trials, how they're telescoped in time, very unusual in some of the ways they designed it. So typically in vaccines or in drug development, you do a phase one trial and that's safety. You then stop, you look at it, then you do a phase two dose escalation trial to see what the right dose is, and then you move into a phase three. So it's usually three phases. All of these trials, including this one, had a flexible study design where basically they kept changing the protocol as they got more data. So it was basically phase one, two, and three all in one, which is highly unusual. Yeah, there are other things that were very unusual about this trial. When you run trials, you typically do not unblind data unless something really bad happens or at the very end of the study or if there's something unusual. And because of the unique nature of pandemic, Janssen said, we need to first really be taking care of people. And so they have made the decision that if physicians who had entered the Janssen trial earlier and wanted to now get the Pfizer vaccine because it's available, that they could choose to unblind themselves and request that. That's very unusual because you don't usually ask to or give subjects that ability to unblind.
Right.
And so just yesterday, we unblinded three physicians. And ironically, two of them who thought that they had got placebo were on active drug.
Oh, so, wow.
So they, you know, didn't need to get the Pfizer vaccine.
Oh, interesting.
So that's very unusual. Another thing that was very unusual about this trial was that you usually don't let study staff get the drug. And you and I've never, ever seen where a principal investigator is allowed to enroll in his own trial. And
like you,
late into the trial, about a week ago, last Monday, they put out something saying, you know, this is so unusual and we don't want to penalize those researchers who are actually helping with the trial, that we will also let you participate in the trial as long as you remain blinded to the pharmacy staff that's actually giving the dose. And so a number of our own staff actually enrolled in the trial, like at least half of them, all of our key leaders all did it because they want access to the vaccine. And then I felt that, you know, I've been running clinical trials all my life, that I also wanted to participate and do that. So I actually entered in my own trial, which is very unusual. And I actually don't know what I got because I'm completely blinded to study staff. However, I did feel just a fair amount of fatigue for 48 hours.
Yeah.
So I have the suspicion that I got the real thing.
That you got it. Well, yeah. So, you know, I, again, you know, everyone saw that I did the trial. I have to tell you, Ken, I didn't feel anything. I got no side effects except just a little soreness from, you know, the shot area.
Right.
For a couple of days. And even now, I did it, what, Thursday. So that it's been 5 days now, 6 days almost. Yeah, five days. There's still a little soreness in my arm, but I still think I got the placebo. But we'll see. You know, I mean, but
you'll see.
Like you're saying, it's so interesting on so many levels how this is being done because this is such an unprecedented pandemic. And so, again, that fear that some may have, the suspicion that this was rushed, maybe corners were cut. You know, there's no, there hasn't been any time to see what the side effects are, long-term effects, anything like that. But you're suggesting that because doctor or scientists themselves, you know, have taken part in the trials, that people should feel a little bit better about the research.
Yeah. And, you know, and even though things were accelerated, safety issues were never shortchanged.
Yeah.
So if there were safety issues, then they were addressed, and they that's a function of institutional review boards, which are independent review boards that look at the safety and look at oversee the informed consents and approve those before they can go out. So the process remained intact. It just was accelerated.
Right, right. It is pretty phenomenal how quickly it was developed. Ken, if you could explain very simply the difference between the Pfizer-Moderna vaccines, which is based on mRNA technology, versus the J&J vaccine. What is the biggest difference between those two vaccines?
Well, so the messenger RNA platforms, which, as you mentioned, are Pfizer and Moderna, basically is coding for a segment of the genome of the viral genome that makes the S protein. And the messenger RNA is actually encapsulated in some lipid particle and then infused in. And actually, the messenger RNA enters your cells and induces your cells to make the S protein, which then induces your body to actually make antibodies against the S protein. The messenger RNA platform is a relatively new technology. It has not been actually introduced in the human population for vaccines ever until this effort. So in that sense, it's new.
Okay.
And in that sense, we don't really know what the long-term side effects are. So there is that fear, because really no one can really say for sure what long-term side effects are, because we just don't know. The next two pharmaceutical companies, AstraZeneca and Janssen, is using a DNA vaccine platform. They use a defective adenovirus, and they inserted the S protein in the vector, and it actually goes into your body and actually gets incorporated into your cells, and then the cells will then make messenger RNA, which then makes the S protein, which then induces your body to develop antibodies. Now, the DNA vaccine platform has been used in probably at least four or five other vaccine platforms already, things like HIV, Ebola, hepatitis. So not widespread, but at least over 100,000 people have been exposed to this platform in for other conditions. So it does have a little bit more experience clinically, but 100,000 people also is not a lot of people.
Right.
When you start talking about side effects that are rare, you need to actually have immunized millions of people, because the side effects like anaphylaxis, where you have a severe allergic reaction, only occur in one to two people for every million doses. So it will take a large widespread use before we're going to see whether there are some side effects that were unexpected.
Well, like already we're seeing some side effects from the Pfizer vaccine, right? There are a couple of people who reacted pretty badly to allergic reactions, right? And now they're saying, okay, if you have allergies, you're going to have an EpiPen just on standby, just in case. So these things are already coming up with the Pfizer vaccine. So again, that adds to the element of fear for folks, right? So what do you say? Because you're an allergist, right? So what do you say to people who might, again, be a little bit fearful and uncertain about potential side effects, particularly if they have allergies?
Yeah, so that's a great question. First of all, one thing important is if you have general allergies to food, to pollen, to dust mite, to latex, those things are not going to make you at increased risk of developing an allergic reaction. So that's number one. So just because you have allergies, you should not say, oh, I should be afraid of getting the vaccine.
Right.
So that's really important.
Because that's a lot of people have allergies, right?
Yeah, exactly. 25% of the population has allergies. And so that would mean, 25% of people cannot get the vaccine. And the American College of Allergy has actually stated that those allergies do not predispose you to an allergic reaction to the vaccine.
Okay.
Now, there is a additive called polyethylene glycol, which is found in the Pfizer vaccine. It is not in the Janssen vaccine. that people can develop an allergic reaction to. So if you do have a documented allergy to other vaccines, you might have an allergy to this PEG, P-E-G, and that could be a problem. And so those are people that should think twice, speak to an allergist, or avoid the vaccine. So that is a very specific group.
Okay.
There's a third group, which is patients who have idiopathic anaphylaxis. And those people have a tendency to have anaphylaxis for reasons we don't know. There's not enough experience to actually know what to recommend, but I would recommend that those people should definitely go back, talk to their allergist or talk to their primary care doctor. And I think just in general, you can't give medical advice like this on a podcast. If you have any questions, go back to your primary care doctor. Yeah. And ask questions because they will know your personal situation much better than making some broad general recommendations.
Right, which people tend to just jump to conclusions when they hear it on the news. You know, one piece of information, they're like, oh my God, that's me. I'm not going to do it. So always good advice to go to see an expert and talk to your doctor. I think the other issue that people bring up often because all these vaccines are starting to roll out is which one's better? You know, should I ask for Pfizer? Should I ask for Moderna? Should I ask for J&J when it comes out? So is that something that you're hearing from people about, like, oh, which should I wait to choose the vaccine? I mean, again, we may not have the luxury to do that, right? It's like when you can get the vaccine, you should just get the vaccine. So what do you say about that? Because there are differences.
Well, I think the first thing is we really don't know which vaccine's better.
Yeah.
We don't know how long the vaccines are going to last.
Right.
Is this something that's only going to last a year? Or we're going to have to get revaccinated? We don't know whether we're going to have to change the vaccine like the flu vaccine. Every year we give a different strain.
Right.
These are all things that we don't know.
Yeah. And it's, you know, also we are learning about a new mutation, right, of COVID-19. And so therefore it does seem to be causing yet another head-scratching moment for everyone.
Right. So this new vaccine was just discovered published widely in the last 48 hours. And basically, there is a new vaccine that was found in the United Kingdom. A new mutation found in the virus in the last 48 hours. And it basically is now 70% of the infections in London have this strain. Apparently, it is much more infectious than the prior version. So it spreads from person to person much more quickly.
Right.
And the unanswered question is whether the current vaccines will protect against this or not. And so people are all looking at that data, and we'll see over time whether the current vaccine products that are out there and the candidates that are being studied, whether we also will get protection against this new strain.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, Ken, again, from a medical perspective and your level of expertise, but also from a personal one, is this something you're like, wow, I've just never seen anything like this before? And again, like we were just saying, this mutation, don't know what it is. We have, you know, we have a lot of questions about it. So just the rapidity of the development of this virus and the way it's infecting people and the way it's changing, it's from even your perspective, it's got to be kind of like, wow, this is kind of crazy.
Oh yeah. I mean, clearly this is like a lifetime kind of situation. We learned in medical school about the 1918 pandemic. And then there was the swine flu in 1976, which turned out not to be as severe as it might have been. But we've always been aware that there is the possibility for an infectious disease to hop over and infect the human population. And we, for a long time, medical science thought it would be an influenza strain that would cause something like this. And it turned out to be a coronavirus strain. So the magnitude of this pandemic and the unusual characteristics of this virus is really unusual. You know, obviously none of us as physicians have seen this. We've all, I always say it's like we're drinking from a fire hose as we're trying to gather information because there's so much try and assimilate every day. But very, very unusual virus. I mean, 50% of the people who actually get the virus never know where they got it from.
Yeah.
And 50% of the people who get it are completely asymptomatic. And so back in July, I actually got the virus.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I did. But it was strange. I run a testing company, and my wife had been exposed to one of her coworkers for about half an hour, and she turned positive. So we said, okay, well, we got to test you because you were sitting next to her for half an hour. Turns out my wife was negative, and I was positive. So I was like mad. Like, what is this?
Wait, so do you think you got it from your wife who...
I don't know where I got it.
That's crazy.
I don't know. That was the most proximate exposure that I could think of, but I have no idea where I got it. So that's a great example of that. And so I said, this has got to be a false positive. I isolated myself, but I tested myself and I was positive on day 1, 3, and 5. I go, okay, I'm going to stop testing myself. I'm positive. And then on day 10, I tested myself again. I was negative. I go, okay. And then my family is very, very strict. I said, well, we're not going to see you until you get 2 negatives. So I tested myself on day 14 and I got myself out of house jail.
Yeah. Wait, but were you asymptomatic?
I was asymptomatic the entire time.
The entire time. See, I have a friend who, same thing. He was asymptomatic the whole time, but he did test positive. And then he took the antibody test and he had antibodies after 14 days.
Right.
So did you have antibodies? Did you test for antibodies?
With the test kits that we had available at the time, my antibodies were negative.
Oh, interesting. God, see?
But that doesn't mean anything because the test kits, the rapid kits for antibodies are not as sensitive than actually doing a blood test and doing what's in ELISA. Much more sensitive, much more quantitative.
Oh.
So just because the rapid test is negative, doesn't mean you don't have antibodies.
Okay.
So I'm also being very optimistic. I the immunity to the coronavirus is two different parts of your immune system. One is antibody immunity and one is cellular immunity.
Yeah.
And cellular immunity is probably more important in terms of immunologic memory and immunity in the future. Mm-hmm. And so I kept telling myself, even though I don't have antibodies, I must have some cellular immunity.
That's the better stuff you want anyway, right? So
yeah, but it's very hard to measure cellular immunity.
Oh, is it? Okay.
So,
is that it, because I think, is that what they refer to as T cells?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
You look at T suppressor cells, T helper cells, and you look at there's a lot, number of act cells that you look at.
Okay. Okay. Well, wouldn't that make sense to create a test that would, an easier test for T cells? Because maybe a lot of us have those.
You can do those tests, but they're very complex. You need to have live cells. You draw the blood. You have to spin the blood down in a very specific way. Then you get the white buffy coat. And then you take that white buffy coat, which has the white cells, and then you actually test it against the particular antigen that you're looking to see whether you get. So the technology exists. It's not a very friendly assay.
Right.
And so it's not something, but the technology is there to measure it.
You know, before we move on, Ken, to talk about other therapies for COVID-19, because you guys work on that too, let's talk about the importance of representation when it comes to vaccine trials and receiving vaccines. There's a lot of talk that often vaccine trials do not include enough people of color, minorities. And I know the day that I went in was the last day of the trials that you guys were conducting, and there were only people of color on that day. You intentionally wanted people of color to come in for the trial. So
that's correct.
Yeah.
So Janssen, from the very start of the study, made a commitment that they wanted to make sure that they represented all different walks of life and different ethnic groups. And so that was a commitment made by the company very early on. And Moderna, interestingly enough, had a 3-week delay in their approval process because the FDA said, you don't have enough people of color in your trial.
Oh.
And that's how... That 3-week delay is what resulted in Pfizer actually getting approval a week before Moderna.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so that's a really classic sort of, well, that was a regulatory sort of snafu, but it actually was a big reminder to anyone who's developing vaccines that, hey, the FDA is paying attention to this. They want to see that you're actually actively engaging the minority communities and make sure they're also participating. And, you know, ironically, it's the minority communities that are being most affected by COVID. Right. They have the highest percentage of incidence, morbidity, mortality, and they are the frontline workers. And so it's ironic that even though they're the ones that most exposed and where the virus is running most rampant, that they're the ones that are often the least have the least access to vaccines or treatments. And so it's and there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, the most notorious was the Tuskegee experiment, you know, where African-Americans with untreated syphilis were purposely untreated so they could be studied to see the ravages of syphilis, which is just the most horrible, unethical. And this is basically, you know, apartheid. In medical apartheid is probably the best way of describing that.
That is a good way to put it. You know,
But now, you know, what it is it's really, there's a lot of distrust. I mean, I saw one poll that only 30% of African Americans will actually want to get the vaccine. That's just shockingly low and going to be really problematic in terms of protecting their community. There's also similar distrust in the Hispanic community. You know, are they experimenting on me? Is this work? And so ironically, what happened in the Janssen trial is that the Caucasian arms filled out first, there were a lot of educated people that all went into this trial, and then they actually closed enrollment to Caucasians and said, for the last week, they would only enroll people of color to make sure that there was adequate representation. Now, our company, our clinical research has, a predecessor company that I ran has actually devoted its research efforts in looking at ethnic differences in pharmaceutical research for the last 20 years. So we have really been pioneers in this field of ethnic inclusion in pharmaceutical research.
Yeah. You know, I remember looking at a recent study that AAPI data did as well on COVID, and I was shocked to see the numbers of Asians affected by COVID dramatically higher in different areas of the United States. And that was relatively unreported. Because usually the focus is on the Black community, Hispanic community, but Asians also have been hit pretty hard. Right. And I remember Karthik saying to me from AAPI data, the reason for those high numbers in the Asian community partly is because of immigration policy. They're afraid if they go to the hospital and get, you know, treated that they'll be ratted out, and the xenophobia because of COVID. Right. That they're afraid that if they went into a hospital or a clinic, they'd be like, oh my God, you're Asian, you have COVID, it's your fault. So the fear kept them away too.
Right, right, absolutely. Yeah, so this is, the COVID pandemic is a great example of showing that we have to have solid public health strategies.
Yeah.
And that viruses don't respect racial boundaries or economic boundaries. And Singapore was a really great example where they had the virus under control, except that they didn't pay attention to their guest workers. And so the virus just was going rampant in their guest workers that were coming from overseas to actually provide labor. And so it's really important that we are including and getting community leaders to actually engage and participate in these programs up front at the research level, and then when vaccination programs are rolled out, that they're also very visible in participating. Because otherwise, if you don't get leaders in each community involved, you're going to have a very low participation rate.
Right. Exactly. They have to set the example. So it's great to see. Right. True leadership when, you know, people in those top positions are publicly getting the vaccine and showing that, you know, look, we got to do this together. So Not right. all, but some important figures are doing it. So we like to see right. that. So Ken, let's talk about therapies because you guys also work on therapeutics for COVID as well as other illnesses. But specifically about COVID, I mean, what is being worked on or what is working? Because we've seen people being treated, namely President of the United States, Rudy Giuliani, you know, very openly have talked about the treatment they received that the average person cannot get. Let's be real, right? We're not going to get that kind of treatment if we get COVID. So what are your thoughts on the treatment where they stand now for the public?
Well, so probably the most promising treatment right now is a category of biologics called monoclonal antibodies. Now, there are two monoclonal antibody companies that are in the lead in terms of development, and they have both received EUA approval. One is a EUA-approved monoclonal antibody from Eli Lilly, and the other is a monoclonal antibody cocktail of two antibodies by Regeneron. And the Regeneron monoclonal antibody is the antibody that President Trump received and is also what Rudy Giuliani received on a compassionate use only and outside of a clinical trial. We're one of the top 20 sites in the country enrolling patients in these trials. And basically, what the data has shown in preliminary data analysis is there's a 60% decrease in hospitalizations and emergency room visits. There is an improvement in viral shedding and an improvement in symptoms. Now, we are blinded with the study, so I personally don't know what they get when they are enrolling in the study. There's a 2 out of 3 chance in the Regeneron study that they will get real drug versus placebo. Okay. And I can just say anecdotally, we have at least a half a dozen or more where people were symptomatic, respiratory issues, fever, and after the infusion, like within 24 hours, they were dramatically better, dramatically wow. better. And I actually think that's what happened with President Trump as well.
Yeah.
Because he was, they've hinted at it, that he had some respiratory issues.
Yeah.
And then within 24 hours, he was like up and going and
right.
doing a little tour of the.
we saw that.
Yeah, we saw
ripped off his mask on the balcony. Yeah, yeah. Just to prove a point. Yes.
So I do think that these monoclonal antibodies are very effective, and the data looks great. Anecdotally, we think we've had some really great responses. We won't know until the data has been unblinded. But if my family or if I myself got COVID again, I would actually opt for a monoclonal antibody treatment. Okay. That being said, there's also some other trials that we're doing that there are some old antivirals on the market. We're not necessarily old, but antivirals that are being repurposed that actually can suppress viral replication. And they are shorter, their time courses of about 5 days. And so we're doing some of those trials as well.
Okay.
And then the other thing our clinical research is doing is we're doing trials testing new diagnostic tests. So there's been a proliferation of molecular PCR tests. There's now 6 or 7 antigen EUA approved tests.
Yep.
And we are working on some antigen test kits as well on a clinical trial basis to study their effectiveness. But
right.
we do need to increase the number and type of tests that are available. And so that's going to continue to evolve over time as well.
Yeah, because Ken, let's be real and very honest. This is not going away anytime soon. I mean, if people think by April, oh, everything's going to be great because, you know, vaccines are going to be rolling out, it's still going to take time for everyone to get vaccinated. Oh. It's still going to take time to see what the results are. And like we hear this term herd immunity, you know, if everyone, at least 70%, we don't reach 70% herd immunity, this is still going to be a problem that we have to contend with. So
I feel that this coronavirus problem is going to be with us a minimum of 3 to 5 years, minimum.
Okay.
Because There are many reservoirs of the coronavirus, not just in within the United States, the people who will not have access to care, but all over the world. This yeah. virus is spread throughout the world. So, and there are people traveling worldwide all the time. Yep. So there is going to be a continual need for screening. And there's going to be continued need to make sure that you maintain your immunity. So this is not a problem that is going away in 3 months. This right. will definitely be here for a minimum 3 to 5 years.
And all the more reason why we have to continue the basic steps and follow the guidelines of mask wearing, social distancing, hygiene, all of that. And on top of that, Ken, you can comment on this, if you will. They don't have the data, Pfizer, Moderna, and I'm sure Janssen at this point, they don't have the data yet in knowing even if you're vaccinated, they still don't know if you can still be infected and carry the virus. You might not fall ill because you're vaccinated, but you still potentially could be carrying the virus and then be able to spread it.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, there is some data with one of the three studies that it may prevent asymptomatic infection. But there is also data, but for the most part, I would say that for all three of them, there's not enough data yet to know whether it actually prevents transmission.
Right.
So you may actually be vaccinated, you may be fine, but you may still spread it to somebody else.
Right. So all the more reason that just because you get vaccinated, you can't be running around willy-nilly, like thinking, I don't have to wear a mask, I don't have to be careful anymore, because you could still spread it.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so very important point.
That is correct.
Honestly, Ken, I mean, this is something that, like you're saying, in all your years, you've never seen, and certainly as a journalist, I've never covered a health story this dramatic that has affected the world in the way it has. So we do have to continue being vigilant, but it is amazing to watch what science can do when they're allowed to do their work. And what research can do when we all come together like this. So I'm sure you too have been impressed by the idea that, wow, you know what? As human beings, when we come together to do something good, we can really do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like this before.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, exciting stuff. And Ken, I'm glad that you're part of it and doing the work that you're doing. So thank you so much for your contribution, because it's great. And then I guess I'll have to find out at some point whether or not I got the placebo or the real thing.
So. Well, I want to thank you for participating in the trial, because it's only people like you that are willing to step up and volunteer. Yeah. That these treatments will be available for everybody else. So, yeah. I mean, you are playing an integral part of, and your role of contributing to make science move on a little bit further. So thank you.
No, you're welcome. And I wanted to do it really for that very reason of representation, because knowing that, you know, these trials need to have people from different communities. So, and I also wanted to tell the audience, listen, we have to do this together. Don't be afraid. We have to do it together to move forward. So, you know, again, setting an example, I guess, somehow. But thank you for that recognition. I appreciate it. And thank you for coming on the show, Ken. It's been great talking to you. Let's just keep me updated on the progress. I can't wait to see what happens with the Janssen vaccine. So,
absolutely. Thank okay. you.
All right. Happy holidays.
Yeah. Happy holidays. Thank you.
So, like I said at the top of this episode, J&J, they are going to be releasing their data, the findings of their clinical trial, phase 3, by the end of this month. And then if all goes well and it looks good, then they're going to apply for fast-track emergency FDA approval, which then will get the vaccine out shortly thereafter. J&J apparently has entered agreement with the U.S., to deliver 100 million doses of the vaccine following the approval. And then there's an option to purchase up to 200 million additional doses under a subsequent agreement. The UK negotiated a deal back in August to initially purchase 30 million doses of the J&J vaccine with an option to purchase up to 22 million additional doses. And then the EU signed a deal with J&J for a supply of up to 400 million doses. So, you know, that's a lot of vaccines floating around. But J&J, clearly they're one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies, so they have the manufacturing capability to produce that many vaccines. And right now, the issue is there needs to be more supply. So the more vaccines that are approved, the more supply that's going to get out there, and the more people can get vaccinated quicker, faster. So that is the situation right now. And I mean, me personally, like I said, I decided to participate because I want to help. I'm curious. And, you know, let's see what happens with me. I should add one thing that's really interesting. What happens in these double blind, usually in normal circumstances, a clinical trial, if you participate, it goes on for like 2 years. You have to stay in the trial for them to get all the data, and you have to repeatedly go in and get tested, and, you know, they take your blood just to see how you're doing. But you never know if you got the placebo or the real thing. That's in normal times. That's how a real, just normal clinical trial takes place. Before a vaccine is approved and so on and so on. Well, we're not living in normal times, obviously. So with COVID, apparently what all these companies are doing that have vaccines is that the participants of a clinical trial, they still participate. They're still supposed to be in double blind, you know, trials. But once it's approved, like the Pfizer and Moderna, what they did was they unblinded their trial for people who were in line to receive the actual real vaccine. So for instance, if a person in the clinical trial received the placebo and their turn comes up to receive the real vaccine, you know, like for instance, they're elderly or they have a, you know, they're high risk, then the pharmaceutical company like Pfizer, for instance, will tell them, hey, you received the placebo, you should go get the real vaccine. That would not happen in a typical trial situation because they would want everyone to not know because they want to continue receiving the data. But in this case, they don't want to put people's lives at risk. So in my case, if I got the placebo, let's say, and then my turn came up in line to receive a vaccine, which won't be for several months because I'm not in a high-risk group. But once I get to you know the front of the line and you know, it's my turn, the company, J&J, will likely tell me, hey, you received a placebo, so you should go get the vaccine. So so just so you know, I mean, because I was a little bit concerned about that as well, but they have notified us and that's kind of what the procedure is going to be. All right, I hope I haven't confused you completely. But I find this interesting and I think we all find it interesting just because we're all living through it right now. So hopefully this was educational, informative. If nothing else, now you know about a couple more vaccines coming out, and the J&J is coming out soon. So let's hope that all of this helps in the fight against COVID-19 and that the vaccines work and that people get the vaccines. But until then, I continue to just beg of everyone to continue practicing, you know, safe, like mask wearing and hand washing and social distancing, all the guidelines, all right? Because this ain't over. It ain't over. We're tired, we're exhausted, but we got to keep up with this because it's not getting better, okay? It's not getting better, but if we follow the guidelines, we can certainly help ease the situation. Think about all the frontline workers. Think about all the doctors and nurses and all the workers who are struggling every day for us, okay? All right, and thank you to you guys. Thank you to the frontline workers. Thank you. Well, that is the show for today. Thank you so much for watching. And again, always, if you haven't followed us on Instagram or Twitter, please do go to those platforms. And also, if you haven't subscribed to The Mei Li Show on YouTube, I would love for you to subscribe. And if you love the podcast, give us a rating. Go to Apple Podcasts and 5 stars would be awesome. A little review would be great. And as always, we do have a Patreon page, The Mei Li Show. If you want to become a patron and become a warrior, we have 3 different tiers that you can join. All right. Okay. Thanks for watching and listening, everyone. Take care of yourself. Stay safe and healthy. Until next time. Bye-bye.